Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel, a reporter and writer of the From the Vine wine column for The Record in Stockton, California. I'm certified level 3 with the Wine and Spirit Education Trust and a part-time tasting room associate at the Lodi Wine and Visitor Center. I hope you enjoy this podcast, which focuses on the Lodi American Viticultural Area. I welcome your comments and reviews on our Facebook group page at recordnet.com/FTV209. And you can follow us at FTV209 on Twitter and Instagram. Welcome to the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Heifel. My great pleasure to be with Lance Randolph, the owner and grower for Pirano Estate Vineyard in Ocampo. Lance, great to be with you. Thank you so much. This is great.
Well, thanks for coming out and joining us in this wet weather.
Yeah, well, we're indoors. We're nice and dry in an office in Pirano's tasting room. But outside, we're getting some rain. So we were going to go out in the vineyard today and take a look around. We're going to have to save that for another day. But there's always work to be done out there, isn't it, Lance?
Oh, yeah. There's no downtime when it comes to the viticultural part or the winemaking part of the business.
Yeah. So we're taping this in kind of early to mid-December for people that are picking this up later. Where are we kind of in the growing cycle right now? What's kind of keeping you busy in the vineyard and in the cellar?
Well, we just actually finished harvest this year quite late in the latter part of November, so we really haven't had it. We're in a regroup process, but prior to this rainstorms, we go into what we do is called cover cropping. Basically, we apply, we seed bed and apply seed, grass seeds, depending on what we want to do in the vineyard or what we're looking for, to supply all our nutrients in the spring. Comes from our cover crop, or reduce the amount of nutrients in our soil, like in Merlot, which does not like nitrogen. You want to try to fixate all the nitrogen in the soil in the spring and take it out of the vine so that you have a better quality product. So we went through, and fortunately just before these rains started, we got done with all the seeding. But it is quite a process. You get done with harvest and then go to your cover crops. Cover crops, my great-grandfather and my grandfather used just natural weeds. And so for many, many years, my father, I'm a fourth-generation grower, my father actually was during that period of time when synthetic fertilizers were very cheap, urea products, and so a lot of these synthetic fertilizers were applied to the ground in massive amounts. So my father used to tell me, take me out as a young man, go to somebody's vineyard and show a very intensely foliaged grapevine that was just beautiful and green, and he'd say, son, that's a very good grower. Look how beautiful that vine is. And today, I take my son out in the vineyard and tell him, if you ever see that, you're in trouble.
Why is that?
Basically, fruit needs sunlight. And so the more aggressive the vine produces lumber, as we call it, or long, aggressive shoot growth that are not necessary for the ripening of that cluster,
right?
That's basically covering up the grapes, and not the exposure for the sun is not occurring. And so that's the thing that you really want to do. See, it's really a balance. It's all about balance, both in viticulture and in winemaking. So that's another reason why we do the cover cropping a little bit in the spring. So for the nutrients, my father dumped a lot of nitrogen in the ground, and we're now trying to fight that and get away from it. And so in the Merlots, for instance, we take and use very aggressive rye, Merced rye. And so in the spring, it grows 6, 7, 8 feet tall.
Wow.
So you actually can't even see the vineyard. It covers it. But when we go to till it and cover it over, then it acts during that whole cycle is absorbing a lot of nitrogen from the soil. And then when you till it into the ground, then it starts to decompose, and it actually takes more nitrogen from the ground to keep it going. So it drops the nitrogen levels drastically in the rows, which is exactly what we want. And it affords a cover crop for the beneficials. These are the good guys out there, that the ladybugs in the fall who've been chomping all year long in the canopy against the bad guys,
right,
the bugs we don't want. They need a place to go vacation. So as soon as Mother Nature takes away all the foliage and the bad guys, these cover crops start growing, and the ladybugs and all the beneficials will go down into that area because there'll be the bad guys in there, and they'll start feeding. And so in the spring, when we cultivate that cover crop for our nutrients, also it allows the ladybugs to come back up into the canopy and start working again. So it gives them a home, a predator's home, basically year-round.
Wow, yeah.
And so it's helps us be a little more environmentally friendly, which has been my goal since I've taken over the vineyards. We've got way too much nitrogen in the valley, and we get a lot of nitrogen from our rain.
Yeah.
So we haven't applied any synthetic fertilizer on this ranch for 40 years.
Wow.
It's all been natural.
Right. You mentioned you're a fourth generation grower, so your great grandfather or your great great grandfather?
My great grandfather.
Great grandfather emigrated from Genoa, Italy. His name was Giacomo Pirano. And what brought him, do you know the family history? What brought him here?
Yeah, actually, the wonderful wealth of the gold rush. So as a young man at the age of 19, he was on a farm, a vineyard in Chiavi, Italy. And so he was kind of slow in getting over here because he was actually only 19 and his parents wouldn't let him go over by himself. But ultimately, towards the end of the gold rush, he came over at the age of 19. He had, back in those days, a lot of money. He had $50.
Wow.
With him.
That's amazing.
And it was big bucks. And so he came over, tried to go up here to the foothills and started mining. Found it was too late. The big, easy pickings were done. So he migrated back down the valley here to, this wasn't a town, this was a community. It wasn't Lodi at that time. And he set up a mercantile business with his $50. So he actually, there was still an active amount of miners were going through the area, and they needed supplies, etc. And a lot of people started to settle in this area. So he originally opened up just the mercantile business. Did that for about 2 or 3 years, and then went back at the age of 21, back over home, and brought back his bride, Maria, who was there, and she was 19, and she came back, and so they set up shop and set up home. And he basically decided to get back into what he did when he was back home in Italy. So when he came back with his bride, with Maria, he also brought back cuttings from the Zinfandel vineyards that the family owned back there. And so he propagated those over the years and basically established what we have now. Actually, it's a larger piece. There was 125 acres of Zinfandel, natural rooted Zinfandels. We're down to 72 acres now. But that's, to this day, is, to my best knowledge, is the largest single natural rooted vineyard, Zinfandel vineyard left in the United States.
Wow, wow. And is it Zinfandel or is it Primitivo or something?
No, it's a good question. Carol Meredith at UC Davis was doing some research trying to find the clone or the origin of Zinfandel. Right. So she actually was out here and I talked with her. Of course, the story goes that she found it in Primitivo in Italy, but actually it originated in Croatia. So we don't know. UC Davis does have what they call a heritage collection of old 100-plus-year-old Zinfandels all across California. We're one of those. I think there's 20 or 30 different clones that they did come and acquire. And so we are propagated for future benefit of the Zinfandel growing regions.
Fantastic.
To utilize those clones.
When were those 125 acres planted?
1895.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. And there, I say there was one block taken out by my father. And then when I came on board, I started as a 4-year-old driving tractor here with my father. And when I went off, I graduated from high school, so I wanted to stay on the farm and farm with them. And he said, no. He said, you have to go to college and be a doctor.
Ah.
And then you can come back.
Uh-huh.
And that was a thing of, supposedly for him, that was a success.
Uh-huh.
So I did start, and it did work to my advantage because it gave me all the chemistry I eventually would need.
Right.
But I did start off in pre-med, went through a couple years of pre-med, and then didn't like that.
Uh-huh.
Didn't have a stomach for it. And so I changed to actually to pharmacy and studied pharmacy school. I went through my first year intern and finally decided that wasn't what I wanted to do either.
Uh-huh.
And so the boots kept bugging me, getting right. back in the ground. And
yeah.
so eventually I came back. My dad didn't want to,
mm-hmm.
didn't want me on the vineyard.
Uh-huh.
So I actually started, I purchased some vineyards across on the other side of town of Lodi. And he was about 72 when I started that, and so I kept farming over there until eventually he decided it was time for him to retire.
Uh-huh.
And so I purchased the vineyards from him so he could retire,
uh-huh.
because all good farmers don't put a nickel away for their life, and they figure it's all going to come to them at some point.
Right, the truth.
And so I was happy to do that,
yeah.
and then he became my sidekick for as long as he, all the rest of his life,
yeah.
pretty much helped me. But yeah, it's a.
There's something about it though. It just got in your blood somehow.
Yeah, it gets in your blood. I mean, I was in a professional level wearing suits and ties,
mm-hmm.
and doing other things, and then I just something kept calling me. I just said, yeah. this isn't me. So
wow.
Came back, put on a pair of jeans and a pair of boots, and I was a happy camper.
Fantastic. What was your dad's name?
Randy is what everybody called him, but Lando was his real name.
L-E-N-D-O?
Mm-hmm.
Lando. Oh, I love that name, Lando.
So a lot of people ask me where the Pirano comes from.
Uh-huh.
So the Pirano actually comes from my mother's side. So we're kind of the Falcon Crest of Lodi.
Uh-huh.
Her name, maiden name was Pirano.
Uh-huh.
So my grandfather worked here, trained, actually my dad and my grandfather basically taught me everything I know in the vineyard business.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where I thought when I took over, I had no real intention in the beginning to start a winery,
uh-huh.
and there was no wineries in Lodi.
What year are we talking?
Early 1990s.
Because I ran across an article about 1992, there was some, I think the Record ran an article about Lodi wines getting some appreciation, and I thought that article was 1992.
Yeah, that would be my first vintage.
That was your first vintage.
That's where it really came from, because there wasn't any other wineries.
Yeah, give me an idea for people who are new to Lodi or visiting now and see all these wineries everywhere. We're up to 85 or so
of
tasting rooms, and then you add on to that all of the others. It has to be hundreds. What was it like in early 1990s when you were just kind of starting out?
Well, like I say, I had no intention back in the,
yeah.
in the 1980s. At that point, I was farming and like everybody else, contracted with other big growers, mm-hmm. some of the bigger wineries in the valley. And it was kind of a strange scenario. I always wanted to make wine. So my experiment was based on, again, a lot of the pre-chemistry that I had gotten from my med school, and I decided in the 80s that it would be kind of cool to make some wine.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually went back to UC Davis and did some extension courses and worked with Dr. Bolton over there to just get up to speed as a winemaker.
Right.
And ultimately in 1991 was our first harvest. We harvest thousands of tons of grapes, but I was going to make 500 cases. So I picked out 7 acres of our old vine Zinfandel that I really wanted to do it. And
was it from that vineyard, mm-hmm. That we were talking
yeah.
about earlier?
Yeah. So my intention just basically was to make a small production of wine and see what we could come with in Lodi. So being the old vine, we're kind of the tradition and the oldest, I thought this would be the best try at it. So I spent more time and more anxiety moments with that first 7 tons that I picked and the first 540 cases. And I was very happy with the results.
Uh-huh.
It was kind of a lead up to the peak, and then all of a sudden, now what am I going to do?
Where do I go from here?
Basically was it.
Yeah.
So I had 540 cases. I remember going into the warehouse and looking at all these 10 pallets of wine.
Uh-huh. What am I going to do with all this?
And that was my whole thing. So I sat down and I figured out how much I was drinking a night. And I figured it would take 35 years to go through it.
Just that. Just not that. Even make
and
any
I said,
more.
Okay, well, I'm okay with that, but I'm not making any more because I can't do that. And so, so a lot of people started prodding me, saying, oh, you got to do this. You got to get, you know, make some more. So the next year we made 1,500 cases. I remember walking into the same old vineyard, and we walked in the warehouse and said, that's, we got to get into the business here. So we started, I started aggressively, basically on my own, because I really figured you got to learn from the ground up what sales are all about. So I basically would take, you know, I'd farm during the day, and late afternoon I'd put some bottles in the, in a traveling bag and go around to the different restaurants and Lodi wine shops and say, hey, I got a Lodi wine. Would you guys want to try it? So it was an amazing experience. My very first lesson on credit was in, I actually was up in Sonoma. There was a two very big Zinfandel places that sold Zinfandel. They're very well known. And so I went into one, both of them actually took the wine. They led the wine. And then when I was there, there was a, in downtown Sonoma, there was a brand new, you know, wine Spectator five-star new restaurant was opening up. So I thought, oh, what the heck, I'll pop in. So I went in, I saw the owner, poured him on a glass, and he loved the wine. He's like, take five cases. He said, when can you get it? And I said, I'll run over to the warehouse right now and bring it back to you. So I came back, made the whole trip, came back, dropped out the five cases, and made out a bill of lading, and he signed it, and I said, okay, here we go. Well, so send you a bill eventually here. So he, within a week, he called me back. He said, man, we went through that five cases and smoked it. He said, we got to have 10 more cases. And so I ran back to the warehouse, got 10 more cases, dropped them off, let them sign the bill again. And so this went on for like three months.
Cool.
And I never billed him. I just, you know, I just kept track of how much he owed me.
Right.
So
right.
I didn't hear from him for quite a long time. So I better stop by and see what's going on. So I drove up. Here's people taking everything out of the restaurant.
Oh no.
And I'm just going, what's going on? And I walked in the back and I said, what's going on here? And so one of the guys that were removing the ovens or whatever, he says, well, they've gone bankrupt.
Oh no.
And I said, oh no. They owe me a bunch of money. Never saw a nickel on that.
Oh
obviously.
No. Gosh.
But they taught me a good lesson. And so my marketing expertise developed right there.
That was a tough lesson to learn, though. My goodness.
Well, it does. It does work. I mean, new guys, and when we started, when I started the winery, I had a lot of local wineries that are today owners come by and talk to me about it. So, you know, what are your experiences about this? And so, it's part of it.
Right.
Especially when you get into start dealing with a three-tier system and, and distributors, it's a very important lesson to have learned.
Right.
But don't regret any of it. Loved it. And, and then we took, like I said, those two shops in Sonoma, actually, before I even started distributing any wine, besides selling it locally here in Lodi and Stockton, several distributors from out of state would come through and always try it, the wines, new wines at those two stores. So I actually ended up with about four out-of-state distributors before I ever even thought about California market. And so they're, to this day, are still some of my better distributors.
Wow.
They picked up and loved the Zin, and they said, we'll take it.
So that's great.
Kind of learned as they went.
Kind of in an accident, almost. Or you really, thank goodness for those two shops in Sonoma. That's really what kind of got you going.
Well, I knew they did a lot of Zins, and, you know, back, like I say, there was no Lodi Zins at that time. And so there was quite a few. They were the source of Lodi Zins. So a lot of the good Zins were coming out of Healdsburg area, Dry Creek area. And so they covered a lot of that territory. And I went over and got to know these guys, and they'd teach me on their Zins, and I'd teach them on our Zins, and we'd compare notes, and it was kind of a little, you know, kind of cool little thing to get started.
There's on your property, I think it's your property, I see it from the highway every time I drive by, these really short vines. I mean, they're like, they come up to your knee at certain points of the year. Are those yours or just south of the tasting room?
No, they actually surround us.
Okay.
The reason they're short, it's kind of also you can date vineyards, Zinfandel vineyards in Lodi area, well, anywhere. But basically, anything that's comes up to your knee was probably circa 1800s to the early 1900s. And the reason they're short was my great-grandfather, Giacomo, was about 5'2". So when in Italy and other places, the style that they do on pruning is what they call head pruning. So basically, they take a vine and bring a trunk up or a trunk up and then establish spurs from that point. Being they're short back in those days, that is why they were planted and cut off and topped at that level, because mm-hmm. it made it easier for them to prune, made it easier for them to harvest, hand pick. Everything they did with it was much, much easier. Then along about 1905 on up, people started getting taller. Mm-hmm. And so there was a change in still using the head prune system. We have some down on the vineyard, part of my vineyard tour. We talk about the difference. You could have one 3-footer over here, and then we go up to a 5-foot or 6-foot vine over here. Mm-hmm. Same concept, basket, what we call basket or spur pruned. Mm-hmm. But it's now very convenient for me.
Right.
So basically farming, it kind of changed with the change in our height and our picking crews and et cetera, et cetera. So same principle, just
different.
1905 on, if you see a vineyard just taller, but it's head pruned, it was planted somewhere between 1905 and then the next phase of changes was when they came out with a thing called a machine harvester, not until the 40s and 50s. So most of that period between 1905 and 1950, those 45 years were all basket or spur pruned vines, but much taller.
So how important was it for you to keep those shorter vines, if I could call them that, in the ground and not pull them and do something else with that property?
Well, my dad did on 25 or so to 50 acres.
Of some of it, yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
And it was because of product demand, mm-hmm. varietal demand. Mm-hmm. Because Zinfandels have, over the lifetime, my lifetime and my father's lifetime, gone up and down, roller coaster.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was times when it just was not economically viable. Uh-huh. And to this day, people ask me, how can you do that? We get 2 ton an acre on the old vines. 2 tons an acre doesn't equate to much product. Mm-hmm. Versus, say, a wire system that'll get 8, 9, 10 tons an acre.
Right.
And the reason we kept it in, my dad kept it in, was kind of the same kind of lineage scenario. Mm-hmm, and the reason I kept them in, and actually, in all honesty, my winemaking attempt was more to decide whether I was going to keep all those old vines in or not. I was at that transition point where we weren't making any money. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, the only way to save these things is to try to make wine from them. And if that works, then we'll keep them in the ground. If it doesn't work, we got to pull them and go to, a more traditional vineyard. So my great-grandfather obviously was looking over my shoulder and said, okay, you made good wine, now what are you going to do with it? So to this day now, we produce probably 15,000 cases.
Really?
From these old vines.
Yeah. 15,000 cases?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. Yeah.
And it's amazing because it's the nice thing about, at least in our wine, mm-hmm. it's from the bottom up. Uh-huh. So there's a lot of wineries, obviously much, much bigger, that produce many, many, many more cases than them, even here in Lodi, but they buy from different vineyards.
Right.
So, and different growers and different people. Right. So the nice thing about Paramus State is that it's a one-man show. I'm in one hand.
You're the one man.
So, as a grower, I'm out there, as I was today. And if things aren't going right or going well, I can pat myself or knock my head off. As a winemaker, I either congratulate myself or I don't. I get very angry with some mistakes I make in the field. Uh-huh. But at least there's a control factor there.
Right.
Even in Napa and mostly in Napa and Sonoma areas, there's very few wineries that our estate that have mm-hmm. that actually produce wine that are grown on their own vineyards, and so they have that total control.
Right.
It's kind of a neat feeling to be able to just every season start off with a fresh season, and Mother Nature gives us different things every year, and as it progresses you have the options or decision to make to formulate your ultimate product mm-hmm. as a winemaker, and then go from there.
Yeah, and over the years your portfolio has grown. It's not just old vines, Zinfandel. How many varieties are you up to now?
That's a good question. Every time I add another one, I go, I shouldn't have done that.
Why am I doing that?
No. I think we're at 14 now.
14?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and Zinfandel, the old Zin was the only thing I actually did make for about 3 or 4 years.
Uh-huh.
And again, going into... as we started to evolve and get bigger, more production, we faced the same problem with that three-tier system, distribution system I was talking about. So we had to start utilizing that. Mm-hmm. We couldn't go out and sell it through the tasting room, or through, at that time we didn't have the tasting room, but go out and sell it for me to go out and sell it. Mm-hmm. So we started utilizing distributors, and those early distributors that came from out of state originally found the wine in Sonoma in their wine shop and discovered it and wanted to have it. That was that new learning curve that I was talking about with the three-tier system. So there's a lot of pros and cons to it. Mm-hmm. And it's a small winery. It worked fine. We were unique. And so these distributors also, wow, you got a great product. And you know, we want to take it on. Mm-hmm. But as time goes on, then they go, well, do you have anything else? Our salesmen are out there. They love your Zin, but mm-hmm. do you have a Chardonnay or do you have a this or this or this? Mm-hmm. So after a lot of more and more requests from, as we started to grow, from distributors, I decided, well, we can't be a one-horse show. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty common even today with a lot of new wineries start up. They start off with a Zin.
Right.
And then they progress and start adding some more varietals mm-hmm. because you just have to have a fuller line right. for the salesman to offer. So, yeah, we added three or four different varietals at a time, and it's challenging. And then ultimately, I go a couple of years without having new varietals, and then all of a sudden, someone wants something different. Mm-hmm. Our very successful right now. We have two red blends. I was actually the first to actually come in California to come out with a red blend, and it was because we had all these different single varietals sitting on the shelf at that time. Now we did have a tasting room.
So when did the tasting room open? I'm sorry.
I want to say about the end of 1990s.
Okay.
So it's been around for about 20 years now. Uh-huh. Again, there was no craze, if you would, for mm-hmm. tasting rooms at that
right.
time.
There weren't that many here.
There was none.
Yeah.
And so
that's not many.
No. it isn't too many. And so actually, it kind of got Robert Mondavi. Who was actually born and raised in Lodi, when he bought the facility down the road from us here, about a mile and a half down the road in Mondavi, Woodbridge by Mondavi, mm-hmm. We talked once, and because the city of Lodi really wanted to open up tasting rooms mm-hmm. to start some tourism with a very small amount of wineries that were around. About that time, there was probably six or eight wineries, and I got involved and we started a little wine group called Lava, which was Lodi Area Winery Group. Mm-hmm. And so people were starting to talk about, we got to promote the products, we got to, you know, have people be able to stop in and see all what's going on. So actually Robert Mondavi came to me and he said, you need to open a tasting room, that little house is perfect. And I said, well, this is the house I was born and raised at. In fact, where we're talking right now was my mom and dad's bedroom.
Is that right?
And
wow.
So we went back and forth. I said, you got a great little big facility over there, and you got a nice little house over there. You could probably do that. You got a lot more money than I do. So it went back and forth. He said, well, you need to do it. So I finally took the leap. It's a lot different than what I expected. I said I'd open a tasting room because I was thinking more like a produce stand. Mm-hmm. So out in the parking lot we have today, that was all peach trees. And so I figured people could pull in. I'd make a hole in there, and they could pull in the peach trees, and they come in the house and, try to what we have as far as wine concerned. And that started the whole movement with the county mm-hmm. and what we could or couldn't do. So a small project for this little house, which had been moved twice. Actually, it used to sit in the middle of that freeway. It was moved back to the fig tree in the back here, mm-hmm. ultimately. But there was a lot of things we had to do, and they wanted paved and this and that. And so we kind of started the whole movement with the county, who were very, very helpful at that time mm-hmm. because they wanted also to see tasting rooms start getting started.
Right.
I worked with a lady down there, the head of the planning commission, and we got through it and we opened up. But it was not what I envisioned at the beginning.
You've seen so much. What changes kind of stick out in your mind? Obviously, there are more tasting rooms. There are more wineries. There are more farming families that are getting into the wine business in the last 15 or so years. And then a lot of people from, let's call them outsiders, although that's probably not a very fair term, but people from outside the Lodi area that have come in and are here now. So the competition is ramped up. I think on the one hand, it has been good. I think people recognize Lodi as a quality wine appellation. I think we're kind of getting out of the the grower identification for this area and getting more into the wines. But what kind of changes have you seen that have been good, and maybe some that you're a little concerned about?
Well, I think the good ones definitely are the viability of the area. When I first started, you know, if I was traveling back east, I'd walk into a wine shop and say, "Hey, I'd like to have you try some Lodi wine," and the first thing they'd say is, "Where's Lodi?"
Where's Lodi?
Yeah. And so I thought, that's got to change. So it has progressed, and especially because of the nature of the tasting rooms today and the wineries that are attached to them, it's opened up something I don't do much of, but the internet concept, and so people are starting to search and find Lodi and try their wines. And most of them kind of like started when I was a young man in college. I used to love to go to Napa and try the wines, because it was really a neat environment back then. Mm-hmm. The Duckhorns and the Camuses and whatever were little small little mom and pop outfits. Most of them working out of the garage,
right.
And most of them were professional people that came from the Bay Area, and that was their summer home, and they enjoyed playing. And they had, you know, unlimited budget, and they were out to produce great wine to impress their neighbors or people that stopped by and wanted to try their wine. Lodi was like that when it first started. I think the same thing. My intention was the same as theirs, and I think Lodi is progressing pretty much the same mold. The biggest change I've seen, probably from that, is kind of what happened in Napa. Outside money, if you want to call it that, or outside people with a lot of money, started building bigger and bigger, more exotic facilities.
Mm-hmm.
Not that mom-and-pop garage or working out of your backyard. It's good and bad. It has improved a lot of tourism. It's developed. I think way back way in the early days, the Commerce wanted to really do something downtown with to help promote the downtown area. I was against it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of a bad guy. I'm the bad boy of the Lodi winemakers or owners or whatever. I just felt it was a wrong fit. I felt that if people weren't going to come from outside and wanted to actually try your wines, they should be in your surroundings, and not in an artificial bar surrounding, but more in an environment where the grapes are actually grown.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason I was against it, and it has been successful. I won't take anything away from the wineries that are down there doing it.
Mm-hmm.
But I still think it's if you're going to be like Napa, we don't have as much traffic problems, so there is easy accessibility. There's bicycling. If you want to do it in the summertime, you can bicycle. In our area here, you can bicycle and see 20 tasting rooms
right
within a 4-mile radius.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that nature hopefully will continue. These are small, some small ones, and there's some big ones. But if the consumers come out, with the concept of tasting wine, then I think it's important that the tasting rooms deliver what their expectations are.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're here to see beautiful wineries, then we have them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're here to experience small mom and pop farmhouse like ours, then we have those too. So it's got both the best worlds right now.
Right. I remember my parents telling the story about how they went to Cape Bread for the first time. And Jack Cape Bread was in a garage and poured wine for him. Boy, it's a far cry from that now.
Oh, and he was probably happy as a camper to do
sure,
that.
Sure.
And
yeah,
that's why I say these are the old timers of the big wineries. They're very known names today.
Right.
Developed from that core.
Right.
And hopefully Lodi does the same thing. And it has. I mean, we all started with Zinfandels, and so we have 85 tasting rooms or wherever.
Whatever, yeah.
Every one of them probably got a Zin.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be surprised if they don't. Well, Aqueous doesn't. They're all white wines. But
right.
99% of them do.
Uh-huh.
And then they branch off from that. So, that's a good thing. And so we're learning what does well here in Lodi and what doesn't do well here in Lodi. Mm-hmm. And so for consumers that are coming from out of town, I think you have a vastly larger selection of unique varietals, wines to taste here in Lodi than you do anywhere else.
Right.
So, again, this is it's going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, pricing stays realistic. I have a problem with that. tasting room. Our tasting room isn't our core business. We are more into distribution across the United States, but it is a very important element for our local people and for the tasting people come in. So I don't charge for tasting. A lot of the different wineries here in Lodi do, and that's fine. I think it, I remember one of the old timers said, you got to charge for tasting. And I said, why? Nobody knows about Lodi. Why do you want to tell someone they got to pay money to taste wine that they had never heard of? So we're probably past that now. I mean, I've gone back a lot of years, but when I was one of the strong ones that said, no, we shouldn't charge for tasting. Yeah. Let people come and experience it, and if they like it, then you make your money by your sale.
Yeah. What are some? I'm still going back to this vineyard that was planted here in the late 1800s. Is there a name for it? Have you all named that vineyard?
It was just called Pirano State.
Pirano State.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, originally it was Pirano Brothers, because my uncle Charlie and my grandfather, or my uncle Bill, and Charlie was my grandfather. Both Piranos, and so it was called Pirano Brothers back in the early 1900s. So that's kind of, I was going to call it Pirano Brothers, but that didn't sound right. So I thought, Pirano State, it's a good name for it. So we used the family name, and it's all state grown fruit, so it goes with that too.
Wow. The other varietals, the other 13 in your portfolio, are those also estate vineyards?
Yeah. Everything we have in the bottle comes from the estate. Everything in the bottle is hand-picked, which is very, very unique. We are the only winery in California that I know that picks Cabernet by hand. It's a nightmare and very, 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 very expensive. But it goes with the whole process of what we do and my style of making wine.
Tell me your style.
I've had been asked the question quite a few times, and I'm always thought, well, I don't really have a style. I like certain things, but I do. We use barrel, new barrels, and old. We use them judiciously because one of the things, the characteristics I don't like is over-oaking. The oak, the barrels we use is for the older barrels we use are basically there for one purpose, and that is they allow oxygen to get into the wine as it's maturing. Where if you have a stainless steel tank, there is no oxygen.
Right.
So complexity, barrel aging allows complexity in the wines to develop, where a stainless steel doesn't. Flavors from new oak are very subjective. I like having a little bit of a hint of oak in my wines, but I don't want to overpower the wine with a flavor from a barrel. And every barrel maker has different characteristic flavors that they think their barrel gives to the wine. I guess the biggest word, my biggest word, is elegance. Again, a vine has to be balanced to produce mature, elegant fruit, and a wine has to be balanced and to produce that elegance. So if there's too much oak in the wine, there's too much alcohol in the wine, a lot of there was a big craze that we've gone through, thank goodness, but these wines were, and Lodi was guilty of doing the same, but it started in Australia, and these wines were just huge, overpowering upfront wines. They only existed and disappeared when they got to the mid palate, but they were just, people were just going crazy over this big style jammy fruit bombs. I used to call them, I won't say what I used to call them, but there's a word for it. And it was an era that we went through after the Australians introduced a lot of wines here, and a lot of the local wineries picked up on it, and I think it's now slowly finally disappearing, and we're going back to producing wines that aren't artificially made. At least the smaller wineries are. I think that's a very key element. The wine industry in general has lost the artistic part of winemaking. It's become more of a production, and that's not wine to me.
No.
Winemaking is a very artistic scenario. The winemaker has to have a palate, or has to develop certain things, and not have a formula like a Coca-Cola or Pepsi and throw it through a machine and then right. come out with the finished product.
That's the same.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
yeah.
day after day.
It's just every vintage is different.
Mm-hmm.
Every varietal changes every day. Some years they're a little bit closer, and sometimes they're way apart because Mother Nature did something to them. So the artistic part of winemaking is that's why I say it's nice to have the fruit farmed by me.
Mm-hmm.
It's to taste that fruit as it's maturing all season and then know ahead of time in my mind where I want to go with this and then adapt a certain characteristic to make that mm-hmm. final product. Where, you know, if I was just selling it to some other, and we do still to this day sell grapes to other wineries. In fact, all the old Zins used to go into the big 3R and the Rosenbloom and the Ridges, and so it's nice now to have complete control of all the grapes and be able to make the wines the way I feel they should be made,
right.
in a more of an elegant style.
Right. Well, anyone who comes here to visit your tasting room, or if we were to come back in the spring, getting into the summer, we'd probably see you in red shorts with the T-shirt and your wide brim straw hat. It's kind of your look. It's kind of what your what do we say? Trademark, I guess.
I guess it's a trademark. It didn't start off as a trademark. It tried to start off basically, I don't like wearing hot jeans in the summertime.
Yeah, right.
And it's grown into something a lot bigger than I thought. But yes, it is a trademark. It's been 40 years now, I think, and going counting. Basically, we didn't have the ranch here. I had the ranch that I was buying on the other side of town, and there were very high exposure to West Lane and some of the other areas where my peers and the growers used to drive by every day. So I remember one day I was out in the middle of the field and it was hot and I was sweaty and I'm not going to do this. So I went into town and I found a sports shop that had these red shirts on sale. I know why now, because they were godly ugly, but
well, they certainly stand out.
They were bright.
Uh-uh.
And so I bought 5 pairs of them and started wearing them. And so to my attention getting scenario, it stood out so much in the middle of the vineyard, I'd be standing out there and my grower friends would come by and honk their horn, their pickups, and yell and scream and make comments.
Right. Some cat calls.
Cat calls, yeah. And then it went on for many, many years until ultimately we had a big grower meeting. Back in those days, there were about 350 growers. And so we had a big meeting, and I was sitting up front with my red shorts on and my T-shirt and hat, and the grower that had the microphone finally got done with his presentation, and he looked down at me, and he said, and then he looked at the audience, and he said, you know, I said, I don't know about the rest of you people, but I'm really getting tired of seeing Lance's skinny legs and those red shorts. So I'm not a shy one. I immediately thought, I'm coming up there, and so I got up, and I didn't know what I was going to say, but I got up there, and I took the microphone, and I said, I'll tell you what. I looked at everybody, and I said, I put these red shorts on April 1st every single year. And as you know, we've got 2 weeks window there where from April 1st to April 15th, we can get a frost. And most of us that are old enough know that we've had one major one once before, and it wiped out the crop. Mm. It not only wipes out your primary crop for that year, but it wipes out the crop for next year, the following year.
Wow.
So you lose 2 years.
2 years.
Of crop.
Mm.
And I said, I don't know about you guys, but I can't afford that.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I put them on, and it's cold out there, but I put them on to keep us from having those frosts. And I said, I don't take them off until all you guys get your grapes off at the end of the year, because as we all know, rains can destroy our crop.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're and catcalling and woofy, woofy, woofy. So about 4 years later, that was in the early 90s. And then in 97, we had a very, very long late harvest. And it was a drought year like we get every 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so things kept getting stretched further and further out. And before we normally have been done with Cabernets, mid-November, we weren't done.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't even started. So I never forget, December 1st, everybody's had everything else except for calves left the valley. And so December 1st, just before the end of November, I looked out, got up in the morning about 5:30 and 6, and looked out, and it was a beautiful day in the valley, and all you could see is Mount Diablo's crystal clear, and a little black cloud over the top of Mount Diablo, and the rest of the valley was just gorgeous. But it was cold. And so that's it. They got Cabernets. It's all, we're good to go. And so I ran back in the house to put my jeans on. Came out to work, started picking that morning. And within about 3 hours, it just got pitch black. And we had 2 loads, equivalent about 3,000 cases of wine picked and hand picked. And so it was going over to the winery, and didn't make it because it just started downpouring. And it rained 2-3 inches in about 45 minutes. And so I pulled all the crew out. And this wasn't a tasting room where we're sitting now. It was my office. And so I came back in. I was drenched. And I was cold. And I picked up my cell phone. And I had 136 calls on it. Missed calls. And I thought, what the heck is that all about? So I started listening to all my missed calls. Lance, do you have your red shirts on? Lance, do you have your red shirts on? So I proceeded the rest of the afternoon to call everybody back, all the growers back that left me voice messages, and said, I assured them I said, I'll put my red shorts back on tomorrow morning, I promise. And so I did. The rain stopped. Couldn't do anything because it was just muddier than heck.
Yeah.
So it took about 2 weeks. By December 8th, I think, is when everybody started back in picking. Had my red shirts on. We picked away. Mm-hmm. Everybody picked for about 2 weeks solid. It was almost the middle of third week in December,
almost Christmas.
Yeah, and the last grower that I knew of said, you know, I'm done. I said, okay. Thank goodness. I went back and put my jeans back on. Next morning it started raining, and we're supposed to be in a drought year where we weren't supposed to rain until February. It started raining. It rained solid for a week solid.
Wow.
So now they call me Mr. Red Shorts.
That's right. You have respect now.
And actually, in more areas than one, this story, after 40 years, has gotten around. So I know a lot of winemakers up in Sonoma and, mm-hmm. and Napa and whatever. They'll give me. They always call me and give me bugs. Say, oh, it's harvest season. You got your red shirts.
Your shorts on.
Yep.
So do you still, to this day, April 1st, we're gonna
April 1st. April 1st. See me in red shirts.
Wow. So death, taxes, and April 1st red shorts
yep.
for Lance Randall.
Yep.
Awesome
yep.
man.
I do not necessarily in that order.
We want death at the end.
Yes, yeah.
Absolutely.
Red shirts can go out first.
Well, we could talk hours. I hope we do this again, Lance. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
What a pleasure. Yeah. Great. Lance Randolph has been our guest on the From the Vine podcast. I'm your host, Bob Highfill. Until next time.